You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 166. I'm your host, Thomas Smith, and I'm so excited to finally, at long last, bring you the recording of the mental health panel I did, I hosted at QED. I was blown away by these panelists, and I wish I had more time. In fact, maybe we can do some follow-up with them at some point. But for now, we'll have to settle for the 50 or so minutes that we were able to have at QED. It was lots of fun. This one was kind of a little scary for me in some ways. I shared a little bit and also I guess I'll make sure to give a content note that this is discussing mental health and some suicidal behavior and a little bit of trauma and stuff like that. So just to let you guys know. But I think it's a very good panel, and I was really proud to have been a tiny part of it. Couple notes. I cut off 10, 20 seconds of bad audio in the beginning, so it starts a little bit abruptly, but that's when the audio got better for some reason. And also, there's some weird noise in the audio. Sorry, it wasn't me. I don't know. I'm just glad we have the audio. It's pretty well recorded, but there seems to be some sort of interference or noise or something. But hopefully it won't bug you too much, because I think it's really good and very worthwhile. So I didn't do bios for the panel because I didn't want to waste that time, and the bios were in the program and stuff like that. But since you guys don't have that, I think I will do that here really quickly. Ariane Shireen is a comedy writer and a journalist. Her work has appeared in, among others, The Guardian, The Sunday Times, The Observer, and The Independent, and she has worked as a scriptwriter for the BBC, Channel 4, and ITV. Her latest book, Talk Yourself Better, looks at the benefits of talk therapy in improving mental health and dealing with psychological or emotional problems. You know, actually, not even mentioned in this, she also was part of, or maybe originated, the bus campaign in England that said there's probably no God, that kind of thing. She mentions it in the recording, actually. Then we've got the hilarious and insightful Robin Ince. Robin is a multi-award winning comedian, writer, and broadcaster, one of the UK's most respected stand-ups. Robin is also co-host of The Infinite Monkey Cage with Professor Brian Cox and Book Shambles with Josie Long. For his work on projects like the Cosmic Shambles Network, he was made an honorary Doctor of Science by Royal Holloway, University of London. His new book, I'm a Joke and So Are You, has just been released, and he was kind enough to give me an advanced copy of that, and I enjoyed it very much. And then finally, Navneet Kapoor. Professor Navneet Kapoor trained in medicine and psychiatry in Leeds, and these days spends his time as a professor of psychiatry and population health at the University of Manchester. He carries out research into the causes and prevention of suicidal behavior, and has done quite a bit of work with the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, developing guidelines to help clinicians better manage mental illness. Okay, so that's the panel, and here you go. Let's get over to the recording.
There's three things that I think I had in mind to try to discuss around mental health, which is kind of visibility and normalization and talking about the stigma, and then moving on to maybe how we communicate about it to friends, family, children, loved ones, and also from there maybe talking about which treatments are scientifically backed, which things work, which things don't. So that's kind of what I have in mind, and then I'm sure the clock will tell me that we can't do all that. We'll see how it goes. But with that said, I don't want to waste too much time. I think our bios are all somewhere, so we don't have to like do a big life story, right? But I thought we'd start with talking about, as I said, kind of visibility, normalization, and I know Ariane and Robin, in particular, were so candid in their books. Ariane's is called Talk Yourself Better, and I'm told it's out, not quite out yet, but very soon, right?
Yeah.
And Robin's, of course, is I'm a Joke and So Are You, which is fantastic, if not a little judgmental title. I feel like, you know, you don't know me, but you were right, but, you know, you didn't know that you were right ahead of time. but okay. But in those books, they're both very, very candid and speak very fascinatingly, openly, honestly about mental health. So I thought I'd start maybe, Ariane, do you want to maybe go into as much as or as little as you want in terms of just kind of what you've dealt with in terms of mental health and some of the issues?
Sure. So I grew up with a dad who was physically violent and emotionally abusive. He used to hit me and my brother for the kind of flimsiest of reasons, and he would threaten to hit my mom. And he was very much a kind of tyrant, and we were all terrified of him. And he used to say to me, oh, you're revolting and you're disgusting and you make me sick. And then I would start crying and he'd say, why are you crying? I should be crying having a daughter like you. And if I cried, I was hit again. And so I grew up in fear of him. And I didn't have a good relationship with my mom either because she kind of enabled his behavior. So she was so besotted with him, so madly in love with him that whatever he did was okay. And she would apologize for it and minimize it and deny it and downplay it. So that was really difficult. And when I got to about 15, I stopped eating and I was referred for family counseling, but it wasn't very helpful because there was a social worker there. So I would say, well, my dad's violent. And my mom would go, no, he's not. He's not, because she didn't want my dad to go to prison or my brother to be taken into care. So then I started self-harming. I made 2 suicide attempts and I was put on a selection of antidepressants, none of which worked. And then at age 24, I fell into an abusive relationship, and I guess kind of unconsciously mirroring my dad's relationship with my mom and my dad's relationship with me. And he turned violent when I was pregnant with his baby, and he hit me in the face, causing my ear to bleed so much that it soaked through a whole tissue. And then he held his hand over my mouth, obscuring my nose, and said that he would kill me. And it happened outside of the country. So when I got back to Britain and I called the police, they said, there's nothing we can do. This is outside of our jurisdiction. And I really wanted to keep the baby because I'd bonded with the baby, but I didn't want to have to see him every weekend for the rest of my life. So, or the next 18 years. So I had a termination. I felt very guilty. Before that, I was pro-life. And I used to say, oh, you know, other women can do what they like, but I would never have an abortion. And when you go through that, you become incredibly pro-choice. I defy anybody to go through that and not become pro-choice. And I went through an awful lot of therapy. Age 28, I ran a campaign called the Atheist Bus Campaign, which were the buses that said, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. And I received an awful lot of hate mail. And I already had mental health problems from the attack when I was 24. And I had generalized anxiety. I had OCD. And the hate mail that I received from the campaign just tipped me over the edge. And I had a full-scale nervous breakdown. Didn't write for 3.5 years publicly. And but I got pregnant again, and now I have a beautiful 7-year-old daughter, and I've been in therapy nonstop for the last 3 years, and I will probably continue to be in therapy for the rest of my life. And I also got put on some crazy meds, antipsychotics, and antidepressants, and anticonvulsants, and I take all 3 of those every day, and I probably will for the rest of my life. But I'm here, and I've written a book, awesome. And I'm speaking to you, and I survived, so yeah, it's all good.
Yeah, I just thank you so much for sharing that. And I have to say that when I read in your book about how your father treated you, and I thought about my 14-month-old, I really had a hard time with that. It just was so, I'm sorry. Having a baby has kind of made me very emotional. So apology for that. But it was really compelling. And I'm so sorry you had to go through that.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll throw it to Robin, same question.
Well, it's, this is going to seem very trite, I suppose. I mean, it's interesting. When you said that, it reminded me actually of someone, because in the book, a lot of it is not about me, it's about other people. And when you just said, I'm here, I survived. And there's a friend of mine that the book is dedicated to called Barry Crimmins. And I don't know if anyone here, as you know, Call Me Lucky, which is an incredible film where... Yeah, did it actually win the Oscar?
It should
have won the Oscar. It's an amazing film. Barry, who sadly died in February, he talked about the fact that when he was 4 years old, he was repeatedly raped, and his sister eventually found it. And at the end of the film, he goes down to what they think may well have been the basement where it happened, and he basically says, "I'm here. Call me lucky." Call me, and he was an incredible. And it was just when you were talking about that fact that by being here, you know that you have. So I would highly recommend, because it's a far more interesting story than I have to tell. I won't even tell you the story, because it's not really. In writing this book, I spoke to a lot of people who've been through incredible and bizarre and horrible things, and trying to work out. This is, I think, one of the interesting things is trying to work out what we are allowed to call trauma, and the fact that I think a lot of people feel ashamed because they go, "I've got this thing, and is it enough?" And I think this is, talking to Philippa Perry, who's a fantastic therapist, she went, that's the thing, especially with children, is it might appear to be a very minor thing, but you don't have to class it as this is the correct level, you're allowed then for that to affect the rest of your life. Oh, that should only affect you for a couple of years, that's something you should just blow over. So when I wrote the book, I kind of wasn't thinking about something that happened to me until, one of the reasons that I only started therapy in July, I'm so new to it, I'm going to have to read your book, and it felt really weird, and I felt like a charlatan, and it felt ridiculous to be doing it, and it still kind of does. But what happened was, every therapist that I interviewed afterwards go, and I presume you're in therapy. And eventually I thought, oh, bloody hell, right. And so I will just tell you this story, and I hope I feel I still, even in the book, I can say it, but basically when I was 2 years old, just before I was 3 years old, I was in a car crash, and I was with my sister, one of my older sisters, and my mum was driving the car, and at the time, I was behind the passenger seat looking for my toy gun, right? So there we go, looking for the toy gun, and then the impact happened. And I looked up, my sister had got her head cut open, my mum was utterly still, and I have that flashbulb memory thing, which is, it was such an incident that it is imprinted. And I remember looking at my mum, who just was still. It was like you couldn't see any of the damage. There was much damage that was inside, but you couldn't see the damage that was done. And I remember saying to my sister, "Why is mummy's eyes closed?" And then the ambulance came, and she was taken off. She was in a coma for quite a while. And the main thing that I now realise was quite important was I thought it was my fault. I thought I'd caused that. And so... I've realized now a lot of the things in my life, a lot of the reasons that I do stand up are one of the things, because often you think, why do people do stand up when they can have anxiety? It is because for 2 hours a night, you control the way you are being looked at, which I think is, you know, interesting. But so that realization that to be a 3 year old or just about to be 3 year old who thought they had caused something that led to their mum being in a coma. And when my mum came out of the coma, she didn't know we existed because she'd come out of coma at an earlier age. To the age that, so she was, I think, probably 17, 18 years old in her head when she came out. And of course, then there were many ramifications in terms of the ensuing years, because it had been a very traumatic car accident and caused her a lot of damage. One of the things that I found hardest when I wrote that, I was very careful in writing the book I didn't want to create collateral damage to any members of my family. And so there's things that I do keep quiet about and that I don't mention because I don't think it's entirely my story to tell, you know, that kind of thing where, but when I wrote about the fact that I thought it was my fault, and I realized that is the major part now of the effect it had on me, none of the rest of my family ever knew that. And so I had a moment where I had to hand the book over to my dad and my sisters. And it's like, oh, this is the bit that I hide. Because you go on stage and you can talk very publicly about some of the strangest things. But if you go, oh, God, me sister's in. I'm not going to talk about it tonight. I can tell this to 500 strangers, but not a member of my family. And so my dad had never known. And at 88 years old, when I spoke to him the other day, towards the end of a conversation, he said, "Why didn't you ever tell me that you thought it was your fault? I could have done something about it." And I still, and now writing about that, there is a sense of guilt that I, because he couldn't have done anything about it because I was a 3-year-old child. And that's part of the thing that I think is fascinating when you are dealing with these issues, is that there is a problem of conversation. There is a, when I said, Dad, what could I have told you? I was a 3-year-old. I didn't know what to say. I wouldn't have been in any way able to verbalize it. So sorry, that's probably a, you know, trite, but it's that now I look back and I go, for me, it was something that we didn't really talk about it. But looking back, it's probably shaped a lot of me, that sense of being a child who did that thing.
Yeah, and Robin, I actually want to go back to what you said in the beginning, because that was so brilliant of you to bring up, and I think it will go perfectly when we're talking, transitioning into talking about stigma, because you mentioned right away, and it's a feeling I'm sure everybody can relate to, or most people. It's a feeling I had when I went through some therapy, which is, well, I shouldn't. What's happened to me? You know, like, what is my... what are my issues in the grand scheme of things? And it's almost like we all have this mentality that if we, you know, look to our right, look to our left, we find someone who's had it worse. Well, then they do stuff and I'm fine. And it's like, well, the whole world will find the one person who's had it worse and that person can go to therapy, but nobody else can because they all have an example. You know, it becomes ridiculous. And I think it was so brilliant to point that out. I think that is part of the stigma and there's many facets now if we can bring you in, and I think we all can comment on this, but that's got to be one part of it, which is, well, I don't want to, you know, yes, I have some issues, but it's not a huge deal relative to such and such in the world and all that. So,
no, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, I've been working as a kind of psychiatrist and academic in the area for about 25 years. And here today, we've got a room full of people talking about mental health issues. You know, that is something that's changed dramatically in my working lifetime. And, you know, thanks to Ariane and Robin for, you know, sharing their incredibly powerful stories and their personal experiences. You know, that simply wouldn't have happened, actually. So we've made great strides in stigma. And why that's important is if we lessen the stigma, then people are much more likely to talk about mental health issues and are much more likely, from my point of view, to seek treatment. And we'll get onto treatments later. But, you know, things work. We can treat mental illness. People get better. So I think that's really important. The stigma is absolutely fascinating because I was trying to think, why is it that mental illness is associated with, you know, quite a lot of stigma, quite a lot of kind of, there's a hidden burden of mental illness, whereas, you know, physical illnesses aren't. And I don't really know the answer to that. I was thinking, you know, is it something about mental illness being hidden? So you can't necessarily tell by looking at someone that they're suffering from mental health, ill health? Is it something about the, you know, the fact that sometimes mental illness people, you know, might behave, you know, not as normal, not as other people might behave? And, you know, it got me to thinking kind of historically, you know, is it because in most cultures in the world, and certainly historically, people have been kind of suspicious or even frightened of mental illness. So is it that historical legacy? But it's kind of so interesting, and it remains. You know, the stigma remains, and you know, events like this, people talking about it, can only be a really good thing.
Can I ask? There's something. Sorry, but something that Philippa Perry said to me, which I thought was tremendously useful, probably the most useful thing that I've heard, and I think we probably know it in one way, but she said, the problem with being human is that we judge everyone else from their exterior presentation and we judge ourselves from our interior. And once you realise that disparity, it doesn't mean it gets rid of everything. But that, and I think in another way, that's also the problem with sometimes dealing with things where, when you're not certain, if doesn't everyone else think like this? Isn't everyone else? And that's, I think, why a lot of people wouldn't want to seek help, is that you eventually make a presumption that probably everyone's paranoid and anxious and in this situation. And that's where.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's incredibly validating, isn't it, when we realise that, you know, our worldview is shared by other people. You know, our doubts, our anxieties, our fears are, you know, are almost universal. So I think, you know, it's an incredibly powerful thing. It makes you feel listened to.
You know, one thought I had about stigma, I just wanted to throw in real quick, was I think it might not be a coincidence that this panel has, you know, two comedians and someone who could arguably be called something like a comedian, creative, you know, people who work in creative pursuits. Because I wonder if, yes, we've made progress in destigmatizing, but I wonder if that's limited to certain categories, you know, because if your surgeon comes in and is like, hi, I'm going to do your surgery. I don't know what it's all for. I don't know what I'm doing here. And, is that still going to be, if your pilot is like, hello, you know, winds are blowing out of the northwest and my dad really messed me up, but I'm going to fly you. I'll do it, you know. I'll fly. You know, could you think maybe there's something there that people who are, there are certain people that as a society, I think we're okay with expressing mental illness. You know, artists, you know, a painter suffering for their art, that kind of thing. What do you think?
That's very true. And that's the first time I thought about it like that. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm absolutely terrified of flying. And I remember saying to somebody, I can't fly. I can't fly. And he said, oh, well, you've got to remember that the pilot doesn't want to die either. And I went, but what if he does? So, yeah. Going back to the stigma, I think that it's different from physical health in a number of ways. I mean, one is that we've all experienced a physical ill health, you know, whether we've had the flu or a broken leg, we all know what that's like. So we can empathize, whereas a lot of people are very, very robust, very, very stable mentally, and they can't empathize. And therefore, they think that mental illness is to do with weakness. So there's that. There's also the fact that people may not want to deal with your mental illness. They may not want to have to deal with your anxiety, with you asking irrational questions, with you seeking reassurance. So, there is the tabloids that often print stuff like schizophrenic murders somebody and ties that into mental health. So that perpetuates the stigma. And as we know, people with mental illness are much, much more likely to harm themselves and much, much more likely to be scared of other people than to harm them. But those aren't, you know, the stories that make the news.
It's interesting, just on that thing about the idea of artists, I was talking to some mental health workers a while ago, and they said it isn't always a positive effect. You know, when someone like Stephen Fry does a big documentary about, you know, but it's because many people still watch that and go, well, of course Stephen Fry suffers from that. He's done all of those great things. And, you know, what we do need to see is it would be good if television stopped being obsessed with always having celebrities as the main star thing. It's not to say it's a bad thing, but that bit of returning to in the 70s and 80s where you go, here's just someone who happens to live in this block. Here's someone who happens to do this job, and they also have mental health. So I think it's an interesting thing that in one way to express these ideas is very useful, but in another way to make sure that you realise it doesn't have to be attached to, oh, well, of course that person, because they write musicals and they do this and that.
Yeah, and we almost glorify it in some people. I think there's certain artists where they're struggling so much, you know. It's interesting.
It is interesting, but I mean, one of the things I think we also need to bear in mind though is we're almost talking about, you know, the pilot with mental illness. That's something that has stayed with the pilot for his life, or the surgeon with mental illness. You know, mental illness is something you recover from. So it might be a surgeon, it might be the pilot, but they might have had 10 sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy, and they might be on an effective drug treatment for their depression, and their depression might be in remission. So this idea that mental illness kind of lasts and lasts, stays with you is not right. You know, we can recover.
Can I ask at what point, this is very, it's almost like, you know, when do we know when life starts? But that idea of what is, when does your mental health get to that point where it would be considered, you know, ill? How do we start to define so that people get a greater understanding of, hang on a minute, I shouldn't be feeling like this. And even though I'm bottling up and the anxiety is going on or whatever, maybe this is the time to at least start asking questions.
Yeah, that, I mean, so that's something we get quizzed about all the time. The difference between normal and illness. And I'm slightly unusual for a psychiatrist, Robin, in that I don't like diagnoses. So I'm a psychiatrist that doesn't like diagnoses. So for me, it's really about how much symptoms or how much the distress is impairing your life. So for some people, you know, they're having very significant symptoms. They're kind of carrying on and they're okay. They're suffering, but they're coping, and they don't want to seek help. And that's kind of okay. But it's about how much impairment it it might have. So does it stop you doing the things that you want to be doing? And so for me, you know, one of the things people get obsessed about is how many symptoms people have or the severity. I think that's unimportant. It's just about helping the person in front of you.
And there's an interesting thing, though. I'll talk very briefly about my dad. I would rather hear you guys talk, but I do want to bring this up because I think it might be interesting and lead into the communication discussion. But when you said that, like, is it interfering with your life? I think what happened with my dad is he just adjusted what his life would be, so that he adjusted his life to a smaller and smaller box of, well, I'll just stay in my room all day and not do anything, and that's my life. And so, no, my mental illness isn't interfering with that. But on that topic, I wanted to maybe go toward communication, you know, how we talk with family or anybody or friends about it. And one thing that really resonated, or rather was kind of a realization for me in kind of what I've dealt with, is as a kid, and maybe you can relate, you know, whatever your parents do, I think, to a certain extent, is just normal. Like, that's just the world. When you're so little, that's all you have, that's the world. And for me, the way my dad was just the way dads are. Like, that's, sure, dads don't do this, they don't do that, they're, you know, such and such, everything, every which thing. And one example that it took me a long time in retrospect to realize, like, oh, that was mental illness. You know, was, well, there's many. One, he declared that he would never go to any of his kids' weddings. I have three siblings. And he just, from early on, he said, I would never, ever go to your wedding. And we were all like, okay, that's the normal thing. Dads don't do that. And then later on, when, you know, we all are now married, you know, it's like, what an asshole. Like, what? And he's agoraphobic. He has horrific anxiety. But he never would, if he would have just said, you know, that's the one thing I keep going back to. And there's one other quick example. Just one time in college, you know, when I was first starting, a little before I started realizing, like, this was not normal, you know, because it still was probably into my early 20s. It was like, oh, this is normal, you know. And one example was someone had gotten some tickets to a football game, which is not football here, American football. And I was super excited, and they had one for, you know, me, my friend, him, and then one extra. And I thought, this will be great, right? You know, my dad loves football. We'll go. I called him, and I said, yeah, this is essentially like, we can go do this. This will be fantastic. And I remember just a long pause, you know, that I didn't understand, and just him kind of struggling a little bit and saying, like, yeah, I'm gonna have to say no. And that was all he told me, you know. And he could never admit that he had any sort of weakness. That's something he just could not do. He had to present this image of being this perfect, strong, you know, authoritarian sometimes father. And in retrospect, I think back, I was so confused. I was like, I didn't understand, you know, like, why couldn't we just do this thing? And if he just said one time in our lives, I have an illness, you know, I have a problem, it would have been so much easier.
That bit, it was just reminding me of the way of kind of sometimes shielding from you, of not being able to talk about, you know, anxiety or sadness. There was a friend of mine who worked for the Samaritans, talked about when they get elderly women ringing up and the game that is played, where it said quite often an old woman will ring up and say, I'm sure I've rung the wrong line. I'm sure this is not the right people to ask. I'm so sorry if I'm wasting your time. But I've got a lot of clothes to get rid of. There are a lot of men's clothes, and I want to donate them to something. Do you know a charity shop in the area I live in? And she'll go, oh, yeah, I'll just check. Oh, yeah, there's an Oxfam in Watford. And then the person then knows to go, oh, can I just ask, by the way, why do you have so many men's clothes? And they'll say, oh, my husband's just died. But they can't ring up and say, wow, I'm having a lot of problems, I've just lost my husband. They have to create a narrative to kind of stop that sense of shame. That why can't you just ring up? It's an incredible merry-go-round, isn't it? And bizarre thing that we can't just go. Things are askew with.
Yeah, I'm really sorry that you went through that, Thomas. And it's not to excuse our dads, but I think that generation, and I think all the more so American men, maybe who were born during the Depression, and also British guys, of course, just got told that you don't feel things when you're a guy. You can feel anger, but that's it. And you just squash it all down and you pretend it doesn't exist because it's weakness and men should not be weak and men should not cry. And it is the saddest, saddest thing. And that's why I think he could never tell you and he could never tell me. And my dad persisted in saying that therapy was something that he didn't believe in. It was stupid. It was pointless. It was a waste of time.
What was amazing is my dad could recommend it for other people, but not... Like he was like, oh, yeah, therapy's great. Yeah, no, therapy's great.
If you're ever doing a show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, you can flyer for every single one of your friends, but you can't flyer for yourself. You know, there's a kind of thing that just goes on where, I mean, I feel like that about emotion. I think my wife saw me cry for the first time after we'd been together for 25 years after an episode of Inside Number 9, which is 12 Days of Christine. If you've ever seen it, it's incredibly powerful.
Have you ever watched a single Pixar movie? Because that's...
I always watch them alone. I know the risks, right? But it's a bizarre thing. And then I found, oddly enough, having done this book, where on two separate occasions, I've suddenly found myself on stage with all of this, you know, you're right, that thing, anger you're allowed. Anger is okay. And I think these things are changing.
I certainly had the reaction to go the other way. It took a long time, but I think, as you've seen me nearly break down and cry a couple times here, like I don't think we should treat people that, you know, if someone cries, I don't think we should perceive them as weak. And I try to not be afraid to do that. And things really upset me and make me sad we should be able to express that. And I think the same goes with mental health. But going back to these questions, and I don't know who maybe wants to tackle this, but again, with having a 14-month-old, I am thinking about this. You know, how should we communicate to our children about it, or if not that, family members? You know, I certainly, friends. You know, if you are having a really bad day, you know, if you're just depressed and can't do anything, which happens to a lot of people in my life, actually. Like, how do you when someone calls you up and wants to do something? You know, how do you communicate that? Should we be open with it? Should we just, you know, I'm depressed. What, do you have any experiences or anything that anyone would like to chime in there with that?
Do you mean with our children?
Either way, either or, you know, yeah, certainly feel free to take on that question first.
Well, I have a 7-year-old and there have been times when I've really struggled and I've just said, mummy's feeling very sad. So if mummy cries, it's just because mummy's feeling sad. And she knows that mummy takes pills every night and she knows that I have to take them at a certain time. And she's just, like you say, it's become her normality. I'm very, very lucky that I work in a workplace where my boss is very understanding. And he said, I've got divorced earlier this year. And he said, you know, if you need to take time. And then he found out because my book's coming out and it's being serialized in a paper tomorrow. And I thought, well, I'd better broach this with him before he sees it or reads it in the paper. And again, he was like, if you need to take any time. So I've been, you know, very lucky that I have understanding people, because there are, of course, employers who aren't understanding. But equally, more and more workplaces have these employee assistance programs where you're offered therapy if you're struggling. And it's not entirely out of the kindness of their heart. I mean, they want to get you back and working. But more and more this is being recognized. And my boss knows about my mental health problems. And I've still had my contract extended a number of times. So, I'm really lucky. And I guess not everybody is that lucky. But talking to children, I think you've just got to be really straightforward. And just say, you know, mummy's not feeling too good. I mean, if you're a woman, if you're a guy, that would be a bit odd. just say that, you know, and just be honest with them.
I don't want to take any more time. I
get asked this a lot. So I specialize in suicide, one, you know, extreme manifestation of mental illness. And, you know, people say, well, you know, when should we talk to kids about suicide? When should we talk to them about mental illness? And actually, kids are really sophisticated. So, at no ages, you know, you're worrying about your 14-month-old, just being open right from the very beginning. And they kind of process what they can. And as they get older, they ask more and more questions. You know, I've got three kids, 17, 14, and 11. They all know what I do for a living. They all have varying understandings of what it is to have kind of mental illness. And I must say their attitudes are kind of exemplary. You know, they learn about this stuff in school. It's amazing. So I think, you know, attitudes are going to really shift in years to come.
No, go on. No, please. No, I was going to say, one thing is, I was interested, because we were talking about this before the thing, about suicide, where, in fact, I remember I did a gig. In the last tour that I did, I talked a bit about it on stage, because I had, I met a woman in Adelaide who was an ex-head teacher, and we got chatting, and she was kind of my wrangler in these gigs that I was doing. And one night she said, I think stand-ups should talk more about suicide. And I knew there'd be more of a story. And she said, my daughter killed herself. And I think if it was out there more, then, but it was a very, when I was doing one gig and there was a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old in the audience, I decided not to do that, because I thought, this is not a thing for that age. And I might be wrong about this, but I thought they're out, and one of them, basically they've both been brought here by mistake, because the parents thought it was another kind of show, and the parents actually went, you can swear or do anything you want. I went, no, I can't, because the rest of the audience are going to go, I can't believe he did that. It's fine for you to give permission. and the suicide, and that was the one bit that I thought, this for me is not the place to introduce it. But I did find, because I think it's something that someone should perhaps do personally. You know, their parents, there's nothing wrong with it at the age of 7 and 9, but a bloke who's just been doing a load of stupid voices, and then Brian Cox does this, oh, by the way, might not be the right, but I might have been wrong about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky, isn't it? Kind of comedy, mental illness, comedy, kind of suicidal behaviour. It's certainly a tricky area. I would agree with you, Robin. You know, talking to kids personally about people hurting themselves, people, you know, ending their lives is kind of okay, but there's a time and a place. I mean, there are some things that we worry about. So particularly kind of in schools, we worry about so-called imitative suicidal behavior. Okay. So, you might have heard this, referred to in the vernacular. I hate the term, but it's kind of copycat suicide. You know, it's a terrible term. That's a well demonstrated phenomenon. Goes back to something you might come across, the Werther effect, novel, 17th century, novel by Goethe, featured a young man who took his own life, and there were a series of similar deaths after the book was published. So there is unequivocal evidence that you know, if you talk about method, if you talk about it in the wrong way, it can be dangerous. But, you know, bearing those things in mind, you know, we need to be open. I think stigma at the moment is a much bigger problem than anything else.
I think openness about sad emotions is different. And I think telling children about that, especially telling boys that it's okay to feel sad, it's okay to cry, I think is extremely important. But I would never personally tell my daughter that I tried to take my own life until she's of the age where she can understand that. I've dedicated my book to her, but she knows she's not allowed to read it, and she's like, mummy, why is it dedicated to me if I can't read it? What age will I be allowed to read it? Mummy, I know some rude words. I know BLUDDY, mummy, you know. You don't need to protect me. And I'm like, well, you know, I do need to protect you, because she's 7, she thinks she's 27, but it's you know, there are some things that I don't want her knowing until she can properly process them.
It is interesting. I do wonder if how much of this actually, I was kind of chuckling. I wonder how much of this is kind of residual damage from some of how it was brought up, because some of the answers to like, yeah, how can I talk to my kid about this is like, well, you just talk to your kid about it. That's what we do. And it's such a, in some ways, it's such a novel thing to me, this idea that you would just be honest about how you're feeling, you know, and I think that's probably my, you know.
But getting the balance right is hard, not for the information, but sometimes I talked to Tanya Barron about this once when I was worried about saying, and she went, sometimes you can just, it can be a much simpler story with your kids. You don't, remember not to go. So another reason that I'm having this particular feeling, and I feel that I shouted at you, and looking back, I was kind of wrong about it, is no, you have to tell a plainer story, because their brains are very good at taking in information. But at the same time, our emotions, you know, I mean, that's part of the thing, again, that I looked at with after the car crash. I was three, one of my sisters was seven, the other was 10. The influence on that, it was very different to each one of us because we had a different level of emotional intelligence. My son, though, at the age of 9, he said, I don't like peanuts after 1960, Dad, right? He loves the peanuts thing. And I presumed it was the drawing. I said, is it the drawing? He went, no, it's Charlie Brown. From that point onwards, he becomes too self-pitying. And I thought, you know, that to have that level of kind of... But I'll tell that story just because in terms of dealing with children, I thought this was an interesting thing that a therapist told me where... Again, about the disparity between what they can understand and the way we express ourselves. There's a friend of mine who we were both talking about when you see someone shouting at a 3-year-old as if they have an adult brain and they're going, why did you smear the yogurt on the window? Why did you? As if the child had a reason, as if the child is going to go, it's the medium I work in at the moment, whatever it might be. And she said... And we both said we really find that unpleasant because you realise that. And she said, "What I do," she said, "is if it's in a public place, and I watch it for, I think I'm going to go up now." And she goes up, and she'll go to the adult, and she said, "I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but you look like you're having a bad day. Are you okay?" And so more often than not, that person will turn on her and start shouting at her. But she says, by that happening, it means the child then goes, "Oh, it's not just me. I'm not the cause." Because that, I think, is one of the interesting, you know, different ages, you know, like I mentioned before, at the age of 3, I was doing something else happened. And of course, one led to the other, one caused the other. You know, again, seeing those different ways of how the brain is developing.
I think that's right. And the other thing you touched upon is the emotional sophistication of young people. So, you know, back to, you know, being worried about the effect of, I don't know, television and media on young people. There was a well-publicised series recently that some of us were worried about, which, you know, did feature some suicidal behaviour as core part of the plot. We were really worried about it. My 14-year-old said to me, Dad, don't ban that series. Don't get it banned. And I was saying, why? She said, well, you know, we know, you know, all my friends watch it and we know the difference between fact and fiction. We know, you know, it was done for dramatic effect. And so, you know, one of these things about us being kind of worried about how we talk about kids are remarkably emotionally sophisticated, I think.
Yeah, I think you're... Sorry, can I ask a question about, just because on that, this is something that I'm still really uncertain about, and I imagine all of you might have been this, is... The trigger warning. Barry Crimmins, for instance, you know, with everything, he hated that idea. He wanted just to go out there and just talk about these things. I know Greg Proops is very different about that. I sometimes, when I did the stuff about suicide, some nights I'd be a bit worried, but I would hope that perhaps because I was in a situation with a room probably not much bigger than this, and a lot of people would probably have some idea of the kind of human being that I am, that there's, you know, there would be a moment of relief when. I think one, by the fact that I'd mentioned in the story that I'd been asked to write it by someone who'd lost someone, immediately that perhaps changed the narrative a little bit. And then once I would get to it's not even really a gag, but I spoke to someone who tried to kill themselves on 3 different occasions. And he just told me this thing. He said, the first time I tried to kill myself, I was going to do it on a Friday. And I was just about to do it. And then I thought, don't do it on a Friday. You'll miss the weekend. And I thought, what a fascinating insight that is into the different ways that our mind worked. And then he tried it on the Sunday. But I'm interested in each one of you, what you think. Because sometimes I get worried, does that mean if you put the warning there, do people then decide not to walk in at all? But equally, because I haven't experienced all those things, is that just the observation of someone who doesn't know what it will be like to accidentally walk into, you know, a scenario which may well be very troubling? I don't know.
I think it depends how it's done. I mean, I think that there are certain topics where I don't particularly like people making jokes about domestic violence, for instance. Whereas somebody who has not experienced domestic violence, it might wash over them. They might not find that upsetting. But again, it does really, it really depends on how that joke, if it's a cruel joke, if it's a joke at the expense of the victim, if it's like a very kind of, you know, I just feel like if it's done with empathy and it's a joke that touches on it, but that's not like the butt of the joke, then that's okay. But it really, I guess it's on a case by case basis. That's how I feel.
So trigger why, like in TV shows, how would you, or radio or whatever it might be?
So I don't know if you were talking about Bodyguard now.
No, I wasn't.
Oh. Okay, but like Bodyguard, there was, I don't know if this is a spoiler. Okay, but there was a scene where he has PTSD and he strangles the woman that he's meant to be protecting. And I did find that distressing, but it didn't stop me watching the rest of the episodes. Because it was done, it was meant to be, it was coming from his own mental illness, and it wasn't kind of on his side, and it was meant to be shocking. And I don't think that, I mean, if it had said trigger warning, violence towards women, I think I would still have been able to watch it, because I would have faith that the writers and that the BBC wouldn't be televising something that was on the side of the perpetrator. It was meant to show how disturbed he was.
You know, I'm just noticing the time, and I just want to make sure we have time to try to go into treatment. We got to, if we just talk about how messed up we all are, and then, oh, done. No, just kidding. But Nav, do you want to launch into that? You know, what are the treatments that are effective?
Isn't? You know, we've talked about mental ill health. The really important thing is there are effective treatments. So one of my jobs is I go to London, I sit on committees at NICE, the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, and we decide what treatments to recommend to the NHS. Okay, so how do we decide what works and what doesn't? We primarily rely on something called a randomized controlled trial. So that's we take 100 volunteers, 50 of them will get one pill, 50 of them might get a sugar pill, and we look to see whether depression, for example, gets better in one group compared to another. So that's how we do it. But equally, you can do a similar thing with talking treatments. And what do we know? Well, we know that talking treatments are definitely effective for mental ill health. There's particular flavors you might have heard of, cognitive behavioral therapy, interpersonal therapy. Ariane talks in great detail and really eloquently about some of the different types of therapy in her book. But there's also drugs, and drugs get a really bad press. You know, you've heard about antidepressants. 2 weeks ago, there was a story about people coming off antidepressants and how difficult it was. Now, I can say I am not in the pay of any drug companies. None of our research is drug company funded. I'm not employed by a drug company, and never have been. But drugs work. Okay, drugs work. If for every 10 people you give antidepressants to, about 6 out of 10 of them will get better. Okay. The problem is that sometimes people get better with placebos as well. So remember those randomized trials I told you about? Sometimes the placebos, those sugar pills, will also have an effect on mood. But the fact is that antidepressants are effective too. Sure, they've got side effects. Sure, you know, for some people they're difficult, difficult to come off of. But for me, it's all about choice. So if you get depressed, if you have an episode of mental ill health, you are entitled to one of those evidence-based treatments, talking treatments, drugs.
Sounds like I better start taking my sugar pill every morning. Yeah, I mean, it couldn't hurt.
I would add a little caveat to that. As a patient, I would say drugs can work. They can work. I was put on an antipsychotic when I really went completely doolally and thought everybody was trying to kill me, specifically MI5 or religious organizations. And that didn't work. It took slightly the edge off, and it made me sleep for 16 hours a day. But it didn't make me feel any better. I mean, I was continually fantasizing about there being a button. The reason I didn't commit suicide was because I was terrified that I would just end up disabled, and I would be sort of trapped in like my own body with my mind active. And I was just fantasizing about there being this button. And if I just press this button, then I would die. When I was 6 months pregnant, I was on suicide forums, desperately trying to find somebody who would, end my life for me. And I started writing to somebody, but we never met up. After I gave birth, suddenly everybody was very concerned, because obviously I had a newborn baby and I had severe mental illness. So I got put on, I saw a psychiatrist. He was very nice. I remember he was very hot.
Is that something you study, that the hotness effectiveness?
And he said, I want to put you on another drug. So I was on a drug called olanzapine, an antipsychotic. Then he said, I want to take you off that, and I want to put you on this other drug, pregabalin. Now, I was on the olanzapine, didn't work. I was on both of them for a week, and suddenly I felt normal. Then I went off the olanzapine and onto the second drug, and I went new again. So it was just that trial and error, just that kind of phase where they overlapped. And if he hadn't had that phase, then I would never have known. But it really is, you know, particular to each different person. And often psychiatrists don't know what will work, and it's just a question of trying a lot of different options and seeing. So I've since added a third drug, which I had to research myself. And I went to the doctor and said, please, can you put me on this drug in addition to my current medications? And he said, well, I suppose there's no harm trying. I mean, it's out of patent, it's very cheap, but it won't, I don't think it will be a magic bullet. And it was a magic bullet. So
I think that's really great. And sometimes, you know, there's this thing about individualized assessment and treatment. I think that's particularly important. It's one of the things we teach medical students, student doctors, you know, particularly for mental illness, it's got to be about the individual. But I wouldn't want you to think that this is all kind of snake oil, the antidepressants and antipsychotics. You know, we know on average that they do work. Sometimes, you know, you do have to work hard to get the right combination, but, you know, there is pretty strong evidence for some of these things working.
But maybe an important message, because I have plenty of friends and family with this experience too, if something isn't working right away, it doesn't mean nothing's going to work, right? I mean, is it a somewhat normal part of the process
One of the really difficult things is, you know, I've prescribed antidepressants, prescribed lots of antidepressants. Members of my friends and family have taken antidepressants, and they can be very effective drugs. But they take 10 to 14 days to even begin to kick in. And that's one of the troubles with psychiatric treatments. We don't 100% understand why they work. They work. Do we understand fully why? No, we don't. So the first thing I always have to try and get across to people is there will be a delay. The second thing is sometimes it can be up to 4 to 6 weeks when they don't work. And then the third thing, you're absolutely right. Just because this drug's worked doesn't mean that another drug work or a particular combination of drugs won't work. So something will help. Sometimes it's about being persistent. It's about collaborative. So myself and the patient or service user, you know, trying to take into account their choice, collaboratively discussing the options. That tends to be the effective things. And I suppose it's no harm if they're hot as well.
And the other thing that I would mention is the side effects. For me, any number of side effects would have been, I mean, I was suicidal. So, you know, you kind of put up with stuff. But I remember, especially when I was on antidepressants, feeling very, very sick, very nauseous. And also not being able to achieve orgasm. And that's like the last thing that's on your mind when you're, you know, it's neither here nor there. I mean, who cares? But some people are just like, oh, I came off it because I couldn't come. It's like, you know, but that's important to some people.
Especially if you've got a hot psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So a mate of mine, what he does when he's prescribing antipsychotics, so when people kind of maybe hearing voices, seeing things, he prescribes a really powerful set of drugs called antipsychotics. And what he does, he says something really interesting, is he writes down all the side effects, and he writes down some of the therapeutic effects, and then he puts them down on cards, and him and the patient go through, and he says, well, look, would you rather have weight gain or drowsiness, and they kind of sort it. And I know that they do have side effects. All drugs have side effects. But with that kind of collaborative approach, you get a much better kind of treatment effect. The patient's happy, and it's much more collaborative, and they kind of know what to expect. So that kind of, you know, that joint decision making is really good.
I want to ask you, one thing a family member of mine has noticed, it's so bizarre. It doesn't seem like this is the way with most medications, but for depression and anxiety, somehow the possible side effects for all of them are always extreme depression and extreme anxiety. It's the weirdest thing. Like, you don't, penicillin, you know, it's not a side effect. You might get a ton of disease or something like that.
Yeah, right. So one thing you should never do is read all the possible lists of side effects of medications. Because they're everything. Because they're everything that's ever been reported about the drug. And yeah, you can get paradoxical side effects. So one of the things we worry about in younger people, you know, drugs aren't the first choice. Antidepressants aren't the first choice if a young person is depressed. Talking treatments are. But one of the things you see is a paradoxical increase in suicidal behavior early on in treatment. So these things you've got to watch, and it's because they are, you know, quite crude drugs in many ways. So there's all kinds of things that are being developed. They're honing treatments. One thing that's really promising at the moment is ketamine as a short-term treatment for depression. Trials are being run. Nasal delivery, nasal delivery of ketamine will be part of the medication. It already is in America within the next 10 years. Okay, so new treatments that are more targeted, I think, are really crucial.
And I love your penicillin comment there. They go, penicillin may well give you syphilis. can I just about therapy? Just that this is it's very, by the way, if you want to know what I've been feeling during the show, I've had quite a lot of anxiety. One man got up there, I thought he's finding it boring. I heard someone cough over there. The second thing is I've had quite a lot of imposter, not syndrome, because it isn't a syndrome. Anyway, but the third thing is therapist, double the moment I started talking about it on stage, everyone who's a therapist in my audience, and there are a lot of them are because they do papers, and this will work. But they go, how did you find your therapist? Because there are quite a few charlatans out there as well, and I think that's one of the important things, just a skeptical thing to know, which is I know a lot of people who've gone and thought, oh, you are able to get into this industry there. So work hard and take as much advice as you can if you're ever thinking of doing that.
And we are out of time. I wish we weren't, but let's thank this panel. I mean, incredible.